Hello and welcome back to episode 2 of season 2 of Widowed AF. I am really excited about being able to bring you this next interview. It is an interview with Stacey Heal, who some of you will be familiar with. She's, I guess, kind of a big fish in the widowed world. And she has recently put out a book called Now Is Not the Time for Flowers. Now, I hadn't read this at the time of interview, but I have since read it. And I think it's a really helpful book, actually, because and actually those people who listen to this will probably get something from it because it's fairly no holds barred. That's the right way to say it. Yeah. And Stacey talks a lot about the kind of the less savory aspects of death. And watching the person that you love kind of disappear before you. She also talks a little bit about widow's fire, which is a fairly contentious and controversial subject in some ways, because it's fairly universal. Most widows will experience it at some point. And it's really nice to have it written about and sort of shine that light onto something that can make you feel pretty guilty. It can make you feel disloyal. It also can bring judgment from others. So page 87, that one is. I even wrote down the page on that one. Now, Stacey is, she's a mother and she has ADHD and she's a widow. So this interview, although we do obviously talk a lot about her late husband, Greg, we also talk about things like parenting and just kind of finding your way in the world. So it is, well, I think it's a really interesting conversation. I got a lot from it. We actually didn't even get as far as an introduction before we started to chat. So there was an initial instant a rapport, and I think that comes across. But I'll be really interested to hear what you guys think. And obviously, this is the first interview that I'm putting out under season 2, so big leap of faith. Right, I'm going to stop talking now, and the next voices you'll hear will be myself and Stacey Heal. Enjoy. I have done a little bit of reading about you, and I have listened to a little bit of a podcast that you did, just because it helps me familiarise myself with your voice and things like that. So it's that'll be the autistic side, and then the ADHD likes to run riot, so that's why I don't tend to do too much prep.
But keep in mind that you are also dealing with somebody who is like an ADHD maniac who literally has I've got no systems in place for anything. I've got just these chaotic notebooks that are full of random notes that don't really make much sense.
There you go. And I was supposed to have one for each podcast. I don't. They're all over the place.
I literally live my life by the seat of my pants always. So please keep that in mind.
I thought I might like you. So we are going to, obviously we're going to talk about the fact that you have a dead husband because, you know, we're both in
that's
the pub. But
that's the thing.
That is the thing, yes. But I also would like to delve a little bit into, you know, we have quite a similar past in some ways from what I've read about you. That sounds creepy. Even to the point that I had my mum sent me the Times article, by the way.
Oh, did she?
Like, oh, who is it you're interviewing, Rosie? Because there's somebody in the Times magazine today. And I was like, yeah, that's her mum. I was like, are you going to show your friends? And be like, look.
That's sweet.
But I noticed your throat wrap thing in your wedding photos is ostrich feather. Me too. Like, I wore an ostrich.
No.
Yeah, serious. Yeah.
Like a cape?
Yeah.
Mine was a cape.
Yeah, I love it so much. And quite a few of my friends have borrowed it for their weddings as well. So it's had a good innings. I know. I'll send you a picture.
Yeah, do. Yeah, I love mine. I absolutely love it.
I was going to dye it and like use it for a festival thing, but I just can't bring myself to. It's from my second wedding, not my first. Right, hang on. Just make sure I'm doing not disturb.
Oh my God, you've got a second wedding. Do you know what? Yeah. This is so interesting and exciting. Is exciting the right word? I think it is. For me to talk to somebody who is, who's had a second wedding. Like, I find that so intriguing.
Technically, I've had three because we got married in lockdown. So we got married on our own. We didn't even take the kids. We just rang our friends and went to a registry office. And so because I like my clothes also. I'm wearing leopard print for you. I wanted to have a party where I could wear a proper wedding dress and have, and also John nearly died during COVID. I don't know how much you know about my life.
No, I did. I did know yes. that actually. Fuck, so that, do you know what? That would be too much.
Well, this is a thing. This is where you go into another relationship because they might die. But he didn't. So yes, I am married to another widow.
Really?
Yeah.
How did you two meet?
We met via through Away, Widowed and Young.
No, because why didn't I? I don't know. Do you know what? I think this sounds awful, but I was immediately put off by the fact that you have to be able to talk to someone, you've got to pay. And I was a bit like, what? I don't know what I want. I don't know what it looks like. So why would I pay a monthly fee when I don't even know what it looks like?
Yeah.
I thought
it looked a bit like a dating agency, ironically. I thought that looks a bit icky.
Yeah, but what I found hilarious about it is that what it does say, like
we're not an dating agency.
It's like, this is not a dating agency, which made me think it absolutely is a dating agency.
Well, I joined, like, you know, because it was a thing to do, and I sort of immersed myself in that world, and it was very sad. And I can remember looking at or reading these kind of posts from people that were maybe 7-8 years into bereavement and thinking, oh my God, is that all that waits for me? Like, just to still be in this place of enormous grief. And basically, a few of us were a little bit more, I think, the dark humor, I guess. And so we sort of formed offshoot groups, and John and I were both in this group. It was his birthday coming up, and we realized we lived not that far away. So I said, look, and this is completely platonic at this point. And I said, look, let's go out for something to eat. And basically, I got really drunk and snogged him through the window of his car. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Oh my God. How long ago was that?
So we got together. Hang on, I've got to think of the timeline. I think it's 4 years this year. So I had been widowed about 2 years at this point. Around 2 years. And I have three kids and he has one. So we kind of blended a lot quicker than you might expect because of COVID. So
yeah,
I was in my house, he's in his house. Then he got sick. So I moved, you know, packed a couple of bags, got the kids and went over thinking I'd be there for a couple of weeks. And then he went into hospital and didn't come out for 5 weeks. So
it was all
a bit of a baptism of fire. But do you know what? I don't know how it works, but it works. So we've since bought the house here. The four kids, you know, they are siblings. We don't really use the word step. It's all, you know, on the surface, that sounds really kind of Waltons. And obviously there's challenges. I got four kids in the house, right?
Yeah.
But it's, I don't know, I guess there's something about the fact that they've all been through a bereavement, that we're all a little bit damaged. You know, John and I, we're still prone to the odd meltdown or breakdown. Like I said, I'm in therapy this morning. So I don't know. It seems to work. I mean, come back to me when the girls hit teenage years.
Oh, don't. How old are your kids?
So my eldest he'll be 14 next month, and he is a bona fide angel. And he's just the nicest kid, and he won't listen to me anyway. Yeah, I know, right? I know. And then I've got Hector, he's 11, and I've got Tabitha, who's 6. And then Holly is John's biological daughter, but she's 10, going on 17.
Yeah. Get ready for those girls.
How old are your girls?
They are 10 and 8.
Oh, so you've got 10 as well.
Yeah, or 18 and 16, basically.
Yeah.
Basically, yeah.
We've just had secondary allocations through, which has been fun because, I won't bore you with that, but, you know, we didn't get any of the schools we wanted, so that's another bloody process.
What?
No.
Oh, it's terrifying. That's terrifying. I know.
I've got
Were you trying out of catchment?
No, we are. So Monty goes to a school. I have kids in four different schools because I hate myself. I know. Holly wanted to go to the school down. It's down the road. We are 1.01 miles. The catchment went as far as 0.09.
Stop it.
So I think we'll get in. We're just going to, I actually spoke to somebody yesterday who's worked in, actually particularly about SEN, but she was saying to me, just don't accept the school place. If you accept the school place, they'll never offer you anything else.
You're done. Yeah. Okay.
But I'm going to keep this in actually, Stacey, because this was good chat. So we're just going to, welcome to the podcast and thank you for joining
me. And thank you for having me.
Well, thank you. So should we just say thank you over and over like a pair of parrots?
Thank you.
So I'm going to just sort of give the listeners a little bit of background. We touched on there that we're both members of the same club, the one nobody actually wants to be a member of, and that'll be the Widow Club. And you, your husband, he died of bowel cancer, which is actually what my alive husband, as I affectionately call him, that's what his wife died from.
And God.
Awful amount of similarities in terms of him. She presented at A&E with, you know, terrible sickness, terrible stomach pains, and was sent home. And you, I literally just listened to a bit of a podcast that you did where you talked about Lynch's syndrome and the fact that Greg had to be tested to see if he was carrier of that genetic mutation. Mm. Sarah did have it. Her dad had it, and so did she. Yeah, but even knowing this and having this on her medical record, they still turned her away repeatedly. It's norovirus. And
are you
hand
serious?
On heart, if it had been diagnosed, and she was also tested every year, and had it been picked up, she probably would still be here. She wouldn't be desperately well. So it was really kind of interesting. It was quite interesting to hear that, because this idea that people in their 30s are just being missed because it doesn't happen to them is really scary. Yeah. And we now find ourselves in the position of not knowing whether Holly has it. And in this country, you can't test until they're 18.
Right.
So, yeah, that's something that we're going to talk about as she gets older. But.
I really understand the terror of that in up to a certain point, because I remember when we were reading about that syndrome, and nobody actually told us. I found that out through my own research, and then I had to ask the oncologist to say, have you done this test in the biopsy? Did you do this? No. Can you? We have two children. And because people would like, why did he have bowel cancer at such a young age? Because he had presented with some symptoms actually years and years before. But because of his age, people were like, you've got IBS. It could be Crohn's. It could be that, you know, go on. He was actually under the care of a gastroenterologist. Is that what it is?
Sounds right.
Who was basically saying, oh, you just need to change your diet. And especially when Greg told some of the medical professionals that he had a dairy intolerance when he was younger, it was almost like, oh, well, that's that then. That's that. Yeah. You just need to eat different food. And then as time went on, it was, you know, and then he was diagnosed. And again, people were like, well, why? Why has he had this now?
People
and obviously
want to know
with cancer.
Reason.
Yeah, there is no rhyme and reason in so many cases. But I remember when we went, when Greg was tested for Lynch, and that weight of having to see if it would affect our children at the time, who were 3 and 1. And I think I put that in a box in my head and locked it with an enormous padlock until we had to go to the genetic center to get the results. And I remember walking into the room and the woman sitting down and just trying to make a bit of small talk with us, which
just
I think is, and I literally just went, look, I don't give a fuck. Just, does he have it? Yes or no? And she tried to again do the kind of the preamble, and I just really shouted at her, yes or no. And because I was like, this is my fucking children. Mm-hmm. You can't, like I've already been told my husband's going to die. This is my kids. And I just, I couldn't cope. And she just said, no, he doesn't have it. And I.
Did you cry?
And it was like, oh, cry. It was almost like something in me unlocked the box that
the
it had been
burst.
Sat in. I can remember so clearly, I threw my head, we were both sat in chairs, I threw my head back like a banshee, and it was like a yelp. Of,
all that pain and fear coming out.
Yeah, it was weird, because obviously it was the kind of the relief, but it was also the pain of everything I'd held in. And it's so like, you know, when kind of how insidious cancer is as an illness anyway. And then when it starts to kind of creep into your family, it's new levels. And I think that especially, yeah, I bet. I really, really bet. And I suppose probably because you can't do anything about it for a long time, I suppose you kind of do have to park it. Because We are. Otherwise, you'll go mad.
Where I interrupted you. Sarah's sister was tested as well because it came from the paternal line on their side, yes. And she doesn't have it. So we are hopeful that Holly won't and that this horrible mutation will be gone from our family. But yeah. Until we test, we don't know. And we kind of talk about, obviously she's 10 now, it's not age appropriate to do so, but do we sort of broach it as almost an inevitability? And so that it's something that if she doesn't have, because even having the gene doesn't necessarily mean you'll get it. But yeah, that's something that, much like you say, we've sort of got, okay, we can't do anything about that now. So let's lock that away and deal with it when the time comes. But the thought, particularly for John, having watched his wife, his vibrant, beautiful, charismatic wife become this hollow shell, the thought of that happening to anyone that we love, it's just awful.
Yeah, it's a lot. And I think also when you have lost somebody, I suppose in any way, there is that never-ending fear that I just don't know how you get rid of. I mean, I've never got rid of it. Who's next? And it's not if, it's when.
Oh my god!
Because we're all going to die. So it's not like, I remember sitting in front of Greg when he was diagnosed in hospital. He was in the hospital bed. He was asleep, and I remember thinking to myself, okay, at least now I know what is the very worst thing that's going to happen to me. This is rock bottom. This is as rock bottom as it gets. How old was I? 36. We had two babies. I was still breastfeeding Bay, our youngest daughter. And I remember thinking, okay, this is it. This is the worst thing. And then thinking, well, no, this isn't a one-time only gig. This is going to be in different ways, again and again and again and again. And I must say, I think I'm strong. I do think I'm strong, but also I don't know how strong I can be to do it again and again and again.
This is where I feel kind of so vulnerable now. I'm so scared of anything else happening because I don't know that I'll have the mental or the physical or the emotional capacity to take that force of the blow again. And my loss was different in that it was very sudden. And often, one of the kind of ongoing, not debates, but conversations around grief is which is worse, right?
Which is better? Yeah.
And the answer
is
neither.
They're both shit. Utter shit.
And the fallout from it, you're right. It is, I'm much like you. I remember almost feeling that I would then be kind of immune from anything terrible happening. And I think it might have been the Terrible Thanks for Asking podcast, and Nora, I can't pronounce her surname, but she said something about
McInerney.
That's it. Thank you. I'm terrible with pronunciations. And it was something about, you think that that's it, but it's not. And there was some stupid things like my lights out of my car got stolen, but that nearly tipped me over the edge because I had to then find the money to replace them when I had 50 quid in my bank when Ben died. I was on maternity leave. And it's all these, and the term secondary loss we hear that banded about, but I think until you actually experience that and the loss of your friends, the loss of your best friend in the case of your husband, perhaps, and your future. And I'm hearing you talking about your daughters, and my children were 7, 5, and 6 months. So it's that need to protect them. But also, how can you protect them? Like Disney stories use this as the worst possible thing that can happen to a child. And you're sort of stood there observing your children go through it. And there is absolutely fuck all you can do. And that is really scary.
Yeah. I remember actually when Greg was in hospital, when he was initially diagnosed, he had to stay in hospital for 2 weeks. And me and the girls were staying with my parents during that time. And so I'd go to the hospital all day, every day to go and be with him. And I remember it was all at the time when they were both obsessed with Frozen, the film. And I remember having to watch on repeat again and again. There's the bit at the beginning where the parents go away and they're on the boat.
At sea, Stacey.
At sea. And they, yeah, yeah. And they just, it's like, they don't even talk about it. They just, like, there's this kind of, like, ominous music. And then you just see the waves taking the boat. And then Elsa and Anna, like quietly singing to each other about being on their own. And I, obviously, they didn't know, they were way too small to explain what was going on. And I don't know if I would have felt any worse if you had literally come at me with a knife, because it was literally like my entire, everything in me was ripped apart. And watching my own children, like, happily watch, you know, sat there in their costumes, their Elsa and Anna matching costumes, watching this and just kind of taking it in and thinking, that's what's happening.
That's actually happening right now.
You just don't know it yet. And that level of pain again. And I think about it all the time. I think about it all the time about things like, you know, my parents having a birthday, and I think about me, but then I also think about, like, how would I tell my children yet again that someone they love has died or is going to die?
Oh, I'm obsessed that my parents are going to die.
Yeah.
In fact, it was their golden 50 years wedding anniversary in December, and they had asked to have a party here in the garden. And you don't need the background, but you're going to get it anyway. And they said, oh, no, we've decided we decided that we're going to go and visit our friends around the country and spend some real quality time with them. And the whole time they're talking, my brain's going, this is a final tour. This is a goodbye tour. They're going to say goodbye to everybody. They're dying. One of them's dying. To the point that I had to just ask my parents, is one of you dying? And yeah. To which they said, no.
What have you not told me?
Yeah. But it is that horror. And my dad had prostate cancer last year, and he's been very, very fortunate, and it was removed and he's recovering really, really well. He's super, super fit and healthy, my dad. He's cycling like 80 miles for his friend's 80th birthday the other weekend. So he's very, very fortunate. But he feels an element of guilt. And he did at the time when Ben died. He would say to me, this should have been me. And of course, in the correct order of things, yeah, it should. But the thought now of losing anybody else that is my protector and my, you know,
do you know what? That really got to me, you saying that. Of like, God, oh my God. The thought that your dad thought that it should be him.
Mm-hmm. I know. And my dad has lived quite an adventurous life. He was a journalist and he went out to war zones and he did kind of reckless, I guess, things and terrified the shit out of my mum for most of our childhood. Not as in he did, but, you know, the circumstances surrounding his work. Just to clarify that. And we actually used to call him Mr. Health and Safety because he was very... He was kind of one of these almost indestructible men, you know, that you don't think anything bad could happen to. So it just made no sense. And although diving is a high risk sport, we know this, I think you don't think of it as being one, you know? Even when the police knocked at my door, I'm still going, well, has he crashed? What's happened? And yeah. I suppose you look around you and there's all these people who are taking enormous risks, who do, you know, not have very much respect for their health, and they're totally fine. And then... Mm. It's that not discriminating, isn't it? That death does not discriminate. It will come at you at some point. But it's just seems so grossly unfair that it can happen to people who are literally in their prime. You know, they're fairly new fathers. They are, I mean, I don't know what your relationship was like. That's none of my business. But Ben and I, we'd gone through that real, I guess, the tricky bit, you know, when you're knee deep in nappies. And although we had rolled that dice again and had tabs, we sort of knew a bit more what we were doing, and financially we had a bit more security. We had, you know, we weren't living in this tiny little two up, two down house like we were with the boys. And I can remember saying to my mum, I can't believe my life has turned out like this. And then it's gone. And I think losing or accepting that terrible things will probably happen again, because nobody goes through life unscathed, and making peace with that. Cause I know what I'm like. I'll worry about the wrong thing happening. So there's kind of no point, but I don't know, telling an anxious brain that is like, I don't know, telling your kid not to ask for a snack, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, what I'm like hearing in you is like you're like that fear, which I totally have as well, and the fact that you have found someone else and that you have got married and that you're bringing your children together, and that is so incredible. And I imagine that brings up brand new levels of fear. And I think I you know, for me, it's been 2.5 years since Greg died, and I knew he was going to die. Like, so I had 5 years of knowing he was going to die. And I have not stepped into that world.
Have yet. You not?
No, no. And it's weird because I am most certainly not in the gang of, you know, like you were saying at the beginning about Wei and about, you know, the people who are 8 years down the line going, oh, I joined a few kind of groups, maybe on Facebook, that were like that. It was like widow, young widow groups. And yeah, the same thing of those people just going, I will never be complete without my John. No. Like this kind of thing. And I'm like, I don't know how to live like that for the rest of my life, where you're kind of saying,
that's it.
Yeah, that's it now. That's mm-hmm. it. Everything else is like diluted. And, you know, I suppose realistically, there is some truth to that, in that, like, I feel that I am very different now. My outlook is really different. I'm a totally different person.
I am.
But even right at the beginning, I was like, no, I can't be one of those women. I don't want to be someone who kind of locks off the idea of love and connection. You know, I've just been through so much shit. I want loving connection. If I can't have it with Greg, I mean, it wasn't my choice. No. It wasn't my choice to not have him. So I'm young. I might possibly have like another 50 years on this planet. But what's interesting is that, so immediately I was like, I'm totally open to all of this as an idea. I really, really was. And I'm wondering, I don't have any ideas yet, really, but I'm pondering this idea now because I'm like, hang on a minute, you're 2.5 years in yet. And for someone who was so like open to the idea of like the world, like love as an energy kind of keeps going. And I don't see that. I've never thought that anybody who moves into another relationship, even if it is a kind of ridiculous, physical, nonsensical, yeah, do you know what, whatever that is, I have zero judgment for them whatsoever. And I feel there's probably a lot to be gained from a lot of that. But for me, I'm kind of looking at myself almost kind of like as an out-of-body experience going, so what's going on with you then? Like, what is this about? Why are you not getting involved with that world? And I don't know, actually, is the answer. I think I've got some ideas in the fact that, like, I've just written a book that's very much all about, it's very much about me. Greg is obviously in the book, but it's very much about lots of different experiences that I've had. And I've really given everything I have to that. And I suppose there's part of me that was also like, that's quite an icebreaker if you were to meet someone going, oh, hi, guess what?
It's a copy of my book.
Yeah, here it is. And just doing this, just going to be doing loads of interviews about this now. You've just got to take this all on board. I don't know. Or maybe that is the bullshit answer that sounds good. And actually what's going on underneath is that I'm terrified.
Yeah. I think probably
I think the bottom of it. I think there's, yeah. Also, like, I was with Greg for a really long time. We got together when I was 26. And the dating world has changed so irrevocably. Not that I have any experience of it, but just like looking in from the outside, it just looks like a horror show. And I protect my peace at all costs in the world now. I really, really do. It's so important to me, and the peace of my children.
And actually, 8 and 10 is quite significant, isn't it, for potential suitors, yeah, entering into a life. I
I think I'd be very careful about it. But, and I think as well, God, I don't know. Do you know what? I think the answer is that deep inside me, I'm just terrified of all sorts of things, all sorts of things. But then I'm really aware that, I don't know, like, does it get harder as you go, like the longer you don't, I don't know.
I think it's a funny one, because when Ben died, and I have made no secret of the fact that he was the love of my life, but I also have another love of my life now. And I think you can have more than one. And the idea that we have one soulmate and that you're kind of, you know, banded together forever. Yeah, there is a truth in that, because I wear, and those are my wedding rings from Ben, and those are my wedding rings from John. I wear both. We have lots of pictures.
I love
of them
that.
I know, so I don't know. It took me ages to do it, because I was really nervous about handing it over. And I'm really pleased with it. But I don't feel, Ben and I didn't divorce. We didn't separate. We didn't cheat on each other. There's no anger. There's a little anger on my part, because he went into the water alone, and he went into the water after he'd been sick. But how many times have I don't know, done stupid things, walked out in front of a car when I was pissed back when I was drinking, you know? We all do things with momentary lapses of judgment. So I've made peace with that myself. Like you, I try and protect my peace. But I didn't come away from it bitter. And whilst I genuinely had this, I'm just going to focus on my kids. And basically, I'm going to be miserable for the rest of my life. At best, I'm going to survive. Like, that was where I thought I was at. And of course, I gradually put my head above the parapet, and I went out and got really drunk with a friend. And... Mum, if you're listening to this episode, please stop now. turn it off now. And I gave my number to a very fit young barman. My friend made me do it. And I can't give anyone, know I'm cringing here, but it broke the seal, shall we say? And I felt awful. I felt like I cheated on Ben. I felt this enormous guilt, but I also felt alive. I felt was a part of me. I'm still a woman, you know. I'm like you. I was 36, or just 37 when Ben died. And I was like, I have so much life to live, and I also have a lot of love to give. And I was really scared, and I didn't think a relationship was on my cards. I thought, and John and I, to be honest, because we were friends, and then, you know, that happened. We sort of thought, oh, well, that's nice, you know, a friend with benefits that you trust, that's not going to, you know, treat you badly or harm you in any way, and. Feelings developed, and that's where we ended up. But I know some people who have been, you know, gone into relationships, and I know others who have, either through choice or because of the cesspit that is online dating, are still single. But I just think it's like, if love comes your way, you just don't say no. If there's kindness and compassion and love, we've been through enough, right? And the world is a pretty cruel place.
Oh my God. If you, like, if people were to see or just feel an ounce of what we have felt, like all of the different emotions that we've gone through within ourselves, with our children, within, like, those, like you said, those secondary losses, and having to navigate these new relationships with literally everybody in our lives, I just don't think people would give widows... And I'm really taking widowers out of this, actually. Widows.
You think primarily females?
I think people give them a very hard time. Not so much men. Because what I often see, especially with people, say, in the media, when people are talking about people like Rio Ferdinand and Kate, where it was immediately was like, oh, my God, look at him alone with those children. He needs a woman. He needs a wife. Those children need a mother. And so people were saying that to him. But at the same time, in the same relationship, people are looking to her going, well, you know, she's not.
Got in there
she's
quick,
not,
didn't you?
Yeah, what's she after? What's she looking for? And my mind was blown by that. You're talking about the same two people, but just different sides of the coin, and how people feel about it. And I agree with you. I think that nobody knows what this feels like, and until you've been through it. And I actually thought, I talk about this in the book, actually, about this weird, weird idea that I had, and I don't know why, before Greg died, that I would go into a relationship, another relationship really quickly. I have no idea why. Well, no, that's not true. I do now. When I wrote the book, I didn't. And then I really thought about it. And you mention Nora McInerney.
Yeah.
As some, right, I realised that it's her. She yep. is the reason why I thought I would end up in another relationship really quickly.
Because she got into a relationship, didn't she? She remarried, yeah, I think, as well, yeah.
Yeah, and she got pregnant a year after her first husband died. And I remember just being just in so much awe of her, of just how she talked about everything so honestly, and about her love for two people, and how this was never how she thought her life would turn out, but she's kind of going with it and accepting it for what it is. And I really saw her as the blueprint maybe of how I wanted to be. I don't necessarily mean like I certainly did not want another baby. Fuck no. But in terms of her attitude about a really scrappy attitude, it wasn't like all toxic positivity and I'm going forward with growth. It wasn't all this. It was like, I'm kind of making my way forward and it's a fucking shit show, but I'm just going with it and I'm grabbing what joy I can because... Everything
says welcome to the shit show.
There's welcome to the shit show. No, exactly. And I really loved that. And I think maybe in my mind I was like, oh, okay. Well, if you do have a certain attitude, maybe if you are kind of going, oh, okay, you know, this is how life is. The introduction to my book is actually called Soulmates Are Bullshit.
Oh, is it?
That's actually what it's called. And it's about a conversation that I had with Greg, and you couldn't make this up. You actually couldn't make this shit up. About 3 days before he was taken to A&E and diagnosed, we had a conversation in bed where we were debating between each other the concept of soulmates.
Which side
and
were you
one on? Of? Oh, I was very anti it because I was like, I was giving all the reasons of like, what are the fucking chances? Like, it's so restrictive. It's meant to be this really romantic, beautiful idea. But actually, if you boil it down, it's so desperately restrictive and controlling in many ways of thinking that you've got to be in the right time, in the right place, in the right
country,
decade, in the right country, the right century, walk down the right road at the right time, all these kinds of things. But also part of my conversation was, well, hang on a minute. What about if, yeah, you found the love of your life, you found your soulmate, what if they then run off with someone from work? Is that you fucked now? You believed that, but they've ruined that. So that's it now. That's your one go. And then I said, what happens if that person dies? What happens then? Is that basically it? Like, at what point do you, like, he very much actually had the same kind of idea of me, nowhere near as enthusiastic, because I think I was kind of on one of my late night rants about stuff and he just really wanted me to shut up and just be like, I just want to read my book.
Sleep
like,
now.
It's like, yeah, it's really late. This is like, I would like suddenly come awake at night and be like, let's talk about some philosophical ideas. And he'd be like, fuck off. But he had the same idea as me, which is there is so much romance and beauty and the idea that we are here and we choose people every day. We kind of continue to choose people. You wake up on a Tuesday and you're like, I continue to be here. I continue to love you. I want to be here. And that there's a huge amount of beauty in that as well. And it was only, yeah, it was literally 3 days later that he was diagnosed with terminal cancer.
Well, once he'd had this diagnosis, and it was terminal from the off, pretty much, wasn't it? You knew there was treatable
away.
But not curable, I think is the term, isn't it? Or
manageable. Do you know what? I've got some really big problems with some of that terminology. I think that the medical world has a huge amount of work to do with that. Because first of all, when Greg was first diagnosed, the surgeon that came to tell us it was stage 4 said, there's nothing we can do for you. that's that, basically. And Greg said to him, strong. Yeah, Greg said, this is in the middle of a ward as well, in the middle of the afternoon. Greg said, how long have I got? And he said, how long is a piece of string?
Oh, fuck and, off.
And so, but
how
that.
Dismissive.
To say, we'd, to say there's nothing we can do about for you, that to me was, oh, basically, you are now going home to die. That's what that meant to me. And then when we eventually saw the oncologist and we were talking about it, I think this word treatable is really confusing for people. It's treatable but not curable. That phrase, I think, it kind of can, maybe it's used as a kind of, it's a very British tool to kind of soften the blow. But I think when people hear the word treatable, they go, brilliant. We can treat it, as in as if it's some kind of chronic illness.
Or I'm thinking like diabetes or something. Something
yeah,
that you can,
you
live
can treat
with.
This. Yeah, you can treat it, but like not curable basically does mean terminal. And also, so many of these cancers have a time span on them. So I think that when people in our world heard the word treatable, I think people kind of went, oh, okay. Whew. Okay, we're all right. And I don't know. I think we could do better about finding ways to talk about things that are honest but don't have to be brutal, but they kind of say how it is without having to maybe give false hope. I think false hope can be really difficult.
That was the two words that were sort of sitting at the front of my mind when you were talking then. And actually, at the risk of making this about me, Ben is still technically missing. He's never been found. And I have had to go to the High Court to have a certificate called a presumption of death certificate.
Oh,
and at the time,
my God.
I know, right? So this idea of false hope is something that is quite personal to me, because when it was the 12th of March that Ben died, and it was an awful, the weather was bad, it was cold, it was dark, the beast from the east had not long fucked off.
Oh my
and
God.
As you perhaps are aware from social media, I mean, I'm a much more prolific user of it than I used to be. I'm still quite rubbish at it. But we were quite private, but he didn't have a Facebook account and things like this. So when he was missing, I did a Facebook post, and I can remember ringing his mom and reading it to her and saying, is this okay? I can remember checking my grandma, you know, all the weird shit you do when your life's being blown apart around you. And kind strangers on the internet would message and say, don't give up hope, sweetheart. God is protecting. He's out there somewhere. And even very early on, I was just like, what you're saying to me is what he swam to France? That he survived a night in minus whatever temperatures, or you're telling me that he's run off, that he's faked his own disappearance.
Oh my God.
So all
I'm so
doing,
angry for you.
I know, so right? I know. The police actually had to search my house, which was a great indignity because it was a mess. But it's the false hope, you know, we all need hope. And as I've come out the other side, I realize how vital hope is just to getting up every day. You have to believe that things will be better, and you have to believe that goodness awaits you, I guess, at the risk of sounding like a real hippie. But in that moment, false hope is so dangerous, because what would happen if I had told my children that he was missing, that I had harbored, you know, and actually you live in Southampton, don't you? So you must have the widowed walks, the houses with the old houses with, you get down by the coast. And traditionally, the widows of sailors lost at sea, you know, they would walk around waiting for them.
And oh, my God, I didn't even know that. How did I not know that? I'm going to write that down because I want to.
You're going to have to try and find one. So, and I thought, that's what, would you want that from me? What, that I have to just wait staring at the sea? And don't get me wrong, there was a period of staring up at the sky and wondering if he was out there. But I had to very quickly shut down hope, because it would have killed me. It would have killed me, and it would have actually prevented me. I would never have got married, would I, if I thought my husband was out there somewhere? I even struggle with the idea of people go, he's watching you. I'm like, I'm fucking hope he's not.
Oh, no. I have problems with that as well. No, I really, really understand this about false hope, because even though we were told that it was stage 4, and stage 4, I mean, I do actually have a really good friend who survived stage 4. She's like an absolute anomaly. I mean, and also
Bionic
she
woman.
Yeah, but do you know what? She carries so much guilt.
Oh.
So much guilt at...
survivor guilt.
At surviving. Yeah, she has survivor's guilt. And I'm like, please don't.
No.
Please just, please be thrilled. But you can't. You can't just tell people how to feel. But I felt the same. And I wonder if this was because I was a parent. I think that for me was a really critical part. So when we were kind of... I spent, I mean, months and months desperately searching the entire world, actually. I was in calls with people in Germany, in America, different places across the world of people who ultimately were selling snake oil about what could we find that could save Greg. And I set out to kind of absolutely go for this. And then I realized quite fairly quickly that this was not going to help me. I mean, it most certainly wasn't going to help Greg. And there was, that, like you said, hope is important. And there is a lot to say for how much it was hope that Greg probably lived for as long as he did. I think his kind of very kind of blindsided hope, he kind of never, ever admitted really out loud that he was going to die. He was hopeful in that way. I think that probably kept him alive for as long as it did. He outlived both his two prognoses. But for me, privately, I could never, ever give in to that false hope because I knew that I was the one that was going to be left. And I knew that I was the one that was going to have to pick up the pieces of our children.
Yeah.
And there is a lot of like mental and very practical preparation that has to go into things like that. And I didn't have the luxury. That's how I would see it. I don't think, thinking about who I am as a person and just how I feel and deal with things, I'm very much more, I much prefer people being upfront with me in general. So I think I would always have wanted to know the real, real truth about things. But it was such a strange line to straddle of needing to really, really keep hope alive over here and be buoyant and be thinking about the future in a future that I knew was not going to happen, while over here having to really be processing and thinking and planning of, okay, I'm going to be a solo parent in who knows how much time. Where are the deeds to the house?
Mm-hmm.
What's the financial provision? What do we not have signed? What are the passwords? What do I need to do mentally and emotionally in order to prepare myself for what's coming, in order for me to not fall apart? Because I'm going to have two really young kids who really, really need me. So I felt like I was living like a bit of a double life.
I've just written double life.
Oh, really?
Down here. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how I felt.
Yeah. And I hadn't, despite the number of widows and widows I've spoken to, I guess I haven't really thought of it like that. That you are, I know from speaking to John and other guests I've had on the podcast that you do become basically an oncologist. You could probably go sit your degree now in oncology.
Yeah, absolutely. But
you are also having to keep their spirits as high as you possibly can, because it was 5 years that he lived with this, with the cancer.
Yeah.
So for 5 years, you cannot be sitting there sobbing about the fact that somebody's going to die. You can't. And it wouldn't have been fair on your girls, because I'm thinking, is Bay the younger one?
Yeah. Bay's.
So she's
eight now, but she was, her whole life, entire life.
And that would have been, and again, just to refer it to my experience, but with Tabby, she was 6 months, so really similar age, really, and now the kind of same age. And I can remember reading that babies absorb your feelings, and I was like, right, I've got to take her to baby yoga. I've got to go do, I don't know, and the antenatal, but you know what I mean, like the mum groups and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. Even though this massive part of me just wanted to get the bottle of gin, go back to bed and rock back and forth, you have to keep their spirits up. You can't allow them to fall through the cracks. And for there to be another tragedy, which it would be if we let them be And like, I know that you mentioned in your book, you know, coping mechanisms and, you know, like letting the kids eat cake off the floor and things like this, you know, all standards slipped. Of course they did. But trying to maintain some positivity, I guess, in a house that has been so devastated, but to have to do that for 5 years whilst your husband is actively, you know, dying in front of you must have been incredibly hard. And I'm thinking again about the girls and having to tell them that daddy is very sick, and then having to tell them again that he's died. So it's like a double grief. And how did you manage to explain to them, A, that he was sick, and then the eventuality that he'd gone?
God. I think it was very much a drip feeding situation where it was really obvious to them that he was very ill, like all the way through, and that he was at hospital a lot. He often had a chemo pump as well at home, which meant, and there were nurses that came to our house a lot. So they knew, and they grew up with that, and it was almost normal because that's all they ever knew.
Holly named Sarah's bag Bob. They named
really?
It because they felt that would sort of take away some of the fear around it.
And I think as Greg got more ill towards the end after his treatment stopped, I think it was only when he went into the hospice and we were told that he had weeks to live, that kind of came out of the blue. Although it wasn't out of the blue. I say that,
it
actually wasn't out of the blue. He'd been taken off treatment maybe something like 4 months, 5 months beforehand. Like, so it's not out of the blue at all. But it felt it.
That little really bit of false hope like in there, isn't it?
Yeah, that shock. We had to sit them down. Well, Greg did. Do you know what? I couldn't tell you what was said.
And did he tell them that he was going to die? He told them himself. That's brave, huh?
Yeah,
that's brave.
Whew, God, yeah, I haven't thought that about that moment actually for a long time. Like I said, I couldn't tell you what was said because it was honestly like having an out of body experience. Because you're kind of, I think it's very rare that you're in a situation where you're thinking, I'm currently in the worst moment of my life. I think that's very rare to be really, really presently in the knowledge that you're living through it right at this moment.
But you're living other people's nightmares. I think that,
yeah.
I felt that Broadchurch was really popular at the time. And I kept thinking, this is like something off the BBC. This is not my life. And I don't know if you did this, but I was always like, am I doing this right in my head? And I don't know whether that is partly a neurodivergent thing, because we're always kind of questioning ourselves, but am I crying enough? Do I look guilty? Like, all these really crazy questions going around my head.
Did you worry a lot about what other people thought of you?
Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah.
Do you remember
my wore makeup?
Really? Wow.
On school run, because I thought people would think I didn't care anymore because I had lipstick on.
Do you know what? I find this so interesting of like how all of these tiny little nuanced movements that we consider in things like that about how other people perceive us. It's interesting, like when I was for Greg's funeral, I wore the most ridiculous elaborate outfit ever, because
I've seen a picture I almost want to redo the funeral so I can
because
one.
I was like oh my God, I was so affronted by the universe that I was like, do you know what? Fuck you, world, universe, God, whoever. If I've got to be a widow, then I'm going to be a fucking widow. And I went in like a proper full, like Queen Victoria's, like the veil, the lace gloves, the big glasses, a little bit Jackie O as well. Big, big lace dress. It was armor. Ultimately as well, it was real armor. But when I was choosing all these dresses, I remember my mum, I ordered a dress, I tried it on for her, and it was I don't even know where you would wear this. It was like a bodice that had it was absolutely full to the brim of huge, big embroidered black flowers. And then it had a train. It was a black train. She was like, Stace, do you think that a train might be a touch too much? And I was like, no, absolutely. Like, I was absolutely indignant about
how
the whole thing.
How dare you?
Because I was like, you, like, I need this to represent the level of sadness and anger and frustration I have at having to fucking do this, having to walk behind my husband's coffin with holding the hands of our two small children. Like, and I think it's interesting, isn't it? If I think my mum was worried about what people would think.
Other people would think, oh, absolutely.
That people, I mean, she's most certainly not somebody who cares what people think actually at all. But I think she became exceptionally protective of me. And I think she knew how many people were going to be there. And I think she was a bit like, I don't want people to come for you. I think she thought that maybe people thought it was a joke, mm-hmm. or that I wasn't taking it seriously enough, or that I was making it about me. I don't know. But I had this weird thought to myself, actually. I remember staring in front of the mirror of like the full get up and thinking what Greg would say and how he'd be laughing at me going, oh, look, here she comes. Here she, look, she, everything's
sealing
a dramatic
the show
moment, isn't it? Yeah. Oh, look, here comes the drama. And that really put me at ease I think when you've lived for so long next to somebody, I don't know if you felt like this. You can hear them. You can absolutely hear what they would say to you. Like, you could be driving down the road and you'll see something and you know what they would say if you saw it. You'd say something and you know what they would say back. And I could hear him laughing at my outfit. And that made me just feel so, so great, because I was like, yeah, this is like, it's not about anyone else. It's absolutely not about anyone else at all.
It's not. It's about you and the kids. And I felt very alone, actually. Ben was one of six, so big family. And my mum and dad were incredible. They were actually in, I can't remember where they were, somewhere in South America, and had to come back. And my mum never went home. My dad went and picked up the car and dropped off their bags. And my mum just came to me. And I'll never forget that minute when she sort of walked across the road and I ran out barefoot, stinking of booze, to greet her. And they have just been like by my side. But my mum is also kind of that generation where you don't bring attention into yourself. And my parents are both journalists, both retired journalists. So my dad particularly does like the sound of his voice. I don't know where I got it from, but never about their private life. It was always... So I think when I first started doing this, actually, my mum was a bit kind of nervous about what I might say. And she was used to say, well, just remember the kids are going to listen to this one day. But I've got a very open relationship. I haven't got an open relationship. Don't be spreading that rumour. But a very open dynamic with my kids. And we talk about things that perhaps are even too grown up sometimes. But I want to be no barriers there. And actually, you mentioned that your girls were at the funeral. My children were there as well. And mine was, there was no coffin, obviously. But it is a controversial decision as to whether or not you involve children in this. And I felt very strongly that we were a unit and we were going to be there together. So my daughter, I held her because she was a baby. And my oldest son, he actually wrote his dad a letter. I wrote Ben a letter, and I don't know how I did it, so I read it. Booze, probably, because I was like knocking back in the pub opposite before. And my middle son, he's autistic, and he was just completely overwhelmed by this enormous... We're not church people, yeah, and for some reason I had it in church, but it felt it needed it, right? And so, but even he had done a little picture that we held up for him, and so I can say to my children in the years to come, you were there, you were with me, we were stood shoulder to shoulder, we were there together. But I can also totally see why people don't want their kids there, because A, perhaps you feel you can't display your own emotion. And also sometimes, I guess it's terrifying for a kid, but I don't know, I kind of think the terrible things happened and the luxury of saying goodbye is something that they need.
Oh, I could not agree more. I feel really, really strongly about this. I think part of my preparation for Greg dying, my kind of secret preparation in the background was contacting charities like Winston's Wish, Child Bereavement UK, and having these conversations with people who are specialists in this area, because that's what I wanted to hear from. I wanted to hear from the people who know about child psychology, not my neighbour down the road.
Who not was your great like, aunt wow, Sandra.
In my day, children didn't go to things like that. I couldn't give a fuck what
didn't
happened.
Didn't have iPads either,
like,
did they?
Yeah, like 50 years ago, I don't want to know about that. I want to know what like the current thinking is on this. And immediately you hear from child psychologists that children absolutely need to be involved in this process because it is all part of the grieving process. There is a reason why we hold funerals. Obviously, they're different. They look differently across the world, but humans have funerals for a really specific reason to do with ritual and processing. And there is something so powerful about that group collective grief that you are walking, literally walking this path together. You are walking into a building with the dead, and there are words spoken and there are tears shed collectively, and there are feelings felt, and that you come out and it is like a collective processing that's so important that it's shared as well. And I think we do children such a massive disservice because they know what's going on and they've got their own feelings. And I think when people talk about, say, like the resilience of children, when they're like, oh, look, they're, you know, their dad's dead, but they're off playing on the trampoline in the garden, they're okay. Children are very resilient. It's like, no, you don't understand. Like, they don't have the cognition to fully understand what's going on. It's going to come out in waves and they process things really differently. And yeah,
did your girls do I was just going to quickly ask, did your girls do that kind of weird psycho thing where you tell them something terrible's happened and then they go and do something really normal? Because my boys did. They made the noise, that awful noise that you never want to hear again ever for the rest of your life. And I can still feel it in me. And we kind of came downstairs. My friend was on the sofa and I was just like, oh, just tell them. And then they kind of poodled down the stairs, both with Harry Potter capes on and wands, and proceeded to enact out some sort of wizardry in the living room. And I was so upset. I was so upset because I thought, what's wrong with them? Why? What's the matter? But now, of course, it's so normal.
Yeah, but that's because we don't talk about this shit. Like, if you literally just have to dip your toe into the psychology of children and grief and know that that is exactly what children do.
But even we do. I remember saying to the police, would you like a cup of tea? And, you know, obsessing in my head that I didn't have my bra on. And, you know, one of my former guests, she was heavily pregnant when her husband died and she was worried about the pile of washing next to her. Like, so if the adult brain does weird stuff like that, obviously the child brain is going to, like you say, they haven't got the cognitive ability or the emotional maturity to process the fact that something of this magnitude has happened and it's happened to them.
Yeah. And I think for us and for me, the kickback that I got initially to do with the girls coming to the funeral, again, I kind of shut that down immediately because I was like, this is no one else's decision. And I talked to the children about it, about what they wanted to do. And they were like, well, of course, it's our dad. And that's the thing, is like, it's not just like, it's not a random uncle that they don't see. It's their dad. So of course they need to go. And also I realized that they needed to be heavily involved, that actually they needed to feel like it was theirs rather than this thing that they felt on the outside of. And so we put things in place which meant that they would actually do that. I was terrified that people wouldn't speak to them and that they'd be ignored at their own dad's funeral and that they'd be
because
kind of looking around.
Didn't know what to say.
No, exactly. And I thought that they would be looking around going, hang on a minute, this is the person that I used to kind of snuggle up to go to sleep with. And there's all these other people here and did they know dad? And I didn't want that for them. So we organized it so that they made masses of batches of cookies a couple of days before, boxed them all up, and that they had a stall at the wake where they sold their own cookies. They had their own big sign. They did it with their cousin, where they were raising money for charities that That's were really amazing. Important. And it meant that the adults had to go and talk to them. And what was incredible about what we saw is that they really got into it. They started bartering with all of the adults. They were like, I see that you've got £10 in your wallet. You've given me five. What else can you give us?
And it became, well, I mean talk about getting them while they're vulnerable. Maybe they've had a few drinks. The poor children's dad's died.
Who's arguing with a bereaved child?
Just
nobody.
Take it. Take the money.
They literally made. I think they made about £1,500.
Stop it.
Just by selling some cookies. But I think that gateway into the wake was really important because we kind of knew that people would want to talk to the key adults. There'd be a lot of people that want to talk to us, and I couldn't be with them the whole time. And I think that really broke the ice of the event for them. And then by the end, we had the wake in a music venue. But, well, by the middle of it, they were doing dance challenges up on the stage. They were asking the adults who were getting more and more drunk as the evening was going on to come up and do like asking them to do like challenging them to dance battles. And what was so wonderful is someone I didn't know actually came up to me at the end and said, I will never see children at funerals in the same way anymore.
See, and changing the narrative out there, Stacey.
And
well
I
done.
Just thought, and I just thought, yeah, because this is important. They've had to, you know, they have had to go through that real process of, you know, seeing the coffin, being behind the coffin, sitting down, listening to people talk. Listening to me talk, they had to hear me say a eulogy and mention them in it. And then we kind of came out the other side, and then you kind of, and I think that's really important. I think the damage is done when you're kind of holding everything in and everyone's telling you that it's going to be okay. And you're like, but what if I just want to kind of lose my mind a little bit? And I think that's what a funeral really gives everyone permission to do.
Yeah,
you're allowed to be really fucking sad as you want. And I think what's important for kids in particular is that you can then come out of that and then go and do something else and go, okay, so I can feel it, but it's not everything.
It's coexistence, isn't it? Happy and sad.
Yeah, exactly. This is not so scary because I can go into these feelings and I know I'm going to come out the other side. And I think that's why we all need that. So yeah, I'm a big fan of children going to funerals.
Love children go to funerals. That's my favourite. One of Ben's university friends, he's a bit of a naughty boy, is Adam, and they came in his camper van and at some point, and I apologise to the Vicar of Herne Hill Church, they did let off a massive firework rocket that got stuck on the church roof. But my kids thought this was
when hilarious. Inside.
So the church has, basically where my kids went to school, there's a really nice pub next to a church, and the pub was where I had booked for our 10-year wedding anniversary. So when I decided to do a church memorial, because you can't call it body without a funeral without body, I then booked the pub for the wake, which kind of made sense in my head at the time. But it's so it was kind of outside the pub that the firework was let off. No damage was done. But it's something that the kids still remember now. They don't remember the mum dressed in black. And okay, I just got to say, you looking for your perfect outfit. I'm a huge lover of Vinted and eBay, as I think you are as well, aren't you?
And
so I was looking for this perfect black dress, and it had to be not too short, not too long, long enough. And then the shoes, I got a pair of shoes from Clarks, Stacey, and I'm not a particular Clarks shoe wearer. Not only were they ugly, they were also really uncomfortable. And I can just remember saying this to people all day, even though they're ugly, they're uncomfortable. But the thought that had gone into this, you know, like I had makeup on and my hair was done. And one of my friends when I arrived, she went, oh, you look lovely. but I felt that part of my relationship with Ben was, you know, he would tease me about, you know, my peculiar taste in fashion but looking nice for him or just in general was so part of who I was. And I really wanted to look my best for him. It feels kind of daft saying that out loud, but that is how I felt. And I think for some people, turning up
impossibly even manage to brush your hair is an achievement. You got there. But for like much like you, it was my armor. If I had that armory on, I was going to be able to stand up in that church. But and that's, sorry, I've gone tangent here there again. But also the a pizza van turned up at the church and people were buying the kids pizzas. And it just ended up being, I guess it turned into a party, which wakes off an hour. And my mum, I mean, she always had concerns about my drinking, as it transpires, rightly so. But it was the one time I can remember where I sat up drinking with Ben's friends till like 3 a.m. And the next day, obviously, I felt like death. And she didn't give me any grief. She just kind of like go sleep it off kind of thing. So you talk about this permission to grieve, which is so important at a funeral. And I think that's what we had. And I kind of sat up reminiscing. I mean, it's unfortunately because of the booze, I don't remember what was said, but talking about Ben's university years and all this aspects of his life that I didn't know. And I think, and the kids went to bed really late and they, like some people came over from work. My house was full. There was a camper van on the drive. It was just, to say that it was fun feels really kind of harsh.
No,
it was.
No,
it was horrible.
Yeah, no, it. I totally understand that. Weirdly, I think that Greg's funeral was one of, again, this is really hard to understand unless you have been through it, but it was weirdly one of the best days of my life because obviously, it was harrowing in a way that I have never experienced before. And I can remember something very specific of like seeing the hearse drive up the road and then being stood outside the crematorium while they while like the six important men in Greg's life came and like carried his coffin. The pallbearer, yeah. That, I mean, those are kind of ingrained in my head as some of the most harrowing feelings I've ever felt. However, the love that I felt for Greg on that day from other people was out of this world. I've never seen that or felt that. It was so collective. There were so many people there and the conversations I had throughout that day, it was so affirming of who he was as a person and the bringing together of people that would never have been together again, like people from all different walks of his life and people who hadn't seen each other for 20, 30 years, reconnecting in the most horrible, awful of ways, but still there was a certain feeling there that was beautiful, and it was because of Greg, and it was a real representation of what he put out into the world.
Because many listeners will know, but also some will not, he was in a band, wasn't he?
Yes.
So music must have been a big part of his life.
Yeah, he had and we also had an open funeral in the sense that it wasn't just private. It was anybody could come. And so actually, I think we probably had around 600 people that came.
What?
Yeah, which is obviously insane. But I also felt really strongly about, I didn't want it to turn into, you know, at weddings, not that I had this at my wedding. I had like just immediate family at my wedding. But that whole thing that puts me off ever doing anything like that, where it's like, who do we invite? Who do we not invite? Yes. And I just thought, I can't get involved in that. And who am I to judge who should be allowed to grieve in the way that they want to and pay their respects? I think that's a really big thing in death. And I really wanted to respect that in others, that if they wanted to come and pay their respects. And I didn't, so it ended up being many people.
A friend who's now a very close friend, but was more sort of an acquaintance at the time, I can remember her messaging me and saying, what is the kind of protocol if you didn't know Ben, but we know you? And I was like, oh, come. Like, if you know me and you know my kids, or it doesn't actually, you know, if you've been touched in any way by his life or by his loss, come. And it's kind of the advice I would give to anybody now is, if you know somebody who has lost their person, even if you feel like you might be being a bit of a vulture by going, or you're not quite sure whether it's overstepping a boundary, go.
Because for me, absolutely. I mean, we didn't quite have 600, but there was a couple of hundred there. And it was to look back at the church and to see people crammed in and to see grown men sobbing because what had happened was so horrific. I needed other people to feel this. And like you wearing the full veil, when my mum would say, oh, so-and-so's asked, is it black or do you want people to wear colour? And I was like, no, I want people to wear black. I'm going to be wearing black.
Yeah. Do you know what is interesting actually, because it was decided within Greg's family that they wanted everybody to wear jeans because Greg was never one for dressing up. He only ever wore jeans. So it was almost like a nod to him. And I loved that. And I think that it made sense. But yeah, for me, I was like, no, I'm not wearing jeans. You definitely all wear jeans. I'm not, because I've got my own agenda with this and that I need to kind of
live out. Yeah, and it's your own. And this is exactly it. You have to do, in that moment, you have to do what feels right, whatever anybody else thinks. And it's just, it popped into my head, so I've got to share. But I took the boys I was with my dad for some reason. I can't remember why. But so my dad watched Tabby in the car and I ran into the big next in Maidstone, so running to get their funeral clothes, right? So I'm in there, one of them's having a paddy about something and this kind of old busybody lady just tutted at me. I went, and you can fuck off. They're shopping for clothes for their dad's funeral. And
amazing.
And that is not who I am, but it's like, fuck off. And this kind of anger came out. And of course I then, bought them these black ties and little shirts and things. And I think Monty might have worn his for about half. He wouldn't wear the tie, just wore a school shirt. Tab looked cute. I got her like a little black dress with a tutu on it. I mean, but was it inappropriate?
Bay,
no, it
Bay was. Wore a Halloween costume.
Amazing. Which one?
It was the same kind of thing. It was
like a widow costume.
Like netting, like a Halloween like netting kind of thing. Yeah, sure, great.
Yeah, exactly. And I got a picture of my dad holding her. And but for me, whilst I fully embrace you wearing colour to funeral, doing whatever works for you, in that moment, yes, I did not want to celebrate Ben's life. I wanted to commiserate the life that would not happen. And it felt important to me. And I guess with not having a body, I actually didn't know whether to do anything. And I don't know even where the idea popped into my head, but I think I just thought, hang on a minute, I should do something because his business was in France. He'd gone to university in Hull. Parents lived on the Isle of Wight. I'm in Kent. So how else can you get everybody together? You need to do that great union and of union. Oh God, I've gone too far now. And I wrote down something that I read that you had said, and it was the importance of the power and healing in community and the collective human experience. Now, I did write this down because it's obviously what I'm trying to do here. This is not for my personal gain. I have made a grand statement. I don't put advertising on the podcast. Now, that was all well and good when I had 10 listeners, but I am actually going to change that. But it's not for personal gain. It is because I felt in the moment of my bereavement that I didn't have anybody who was like me. And Norma McKinney, I love her and I found her hugely helpful. But also, she's American, right? And so, you're desperate for that sense of connection. And I think by talking about it, by writing about it, what we do is we do open up our world and go, hiya, we're here in our leopard print and our pink hair. It's not all old ladies crying into their cups of tea. That we are still young and vibrant. And I guess that term changing the narrative is a bit cliche, but that is kind of what I want to do. And I know that's what you're doing as well. So let's talk a little bit about your book, which is not even out for purchase. Yes, I have pre-ordered mine today. So I thought it'd be very disingenuous.
Thank you so much.
I thought it would be very disingenuous to invite you on and then not have purchased it. So it is called Now Is Not the Time for Flowers. Which I like a lot. And a while ago, in fact, not long after I launched the podcast, I did a list of things to and not to do when somebody dies. And I think probably top of my list of not is flowers. And I felt really ungrateful because people did send me flowers, but they're just another thing to die.
Another thing to watch die. And they're another thing to look after.
Yes.
they're another thing to think about.
Guilt.
And search, yeah, to feel guilty about, to search for receptacles to put them in, to look after, to watch die. Yeah, it's a problem.
So obviously that is where the inspiration for the title of your book came from.
No, it's not actually.
That serves me right for being smug and saying obviously.
It was only afterwards that I realized of like, oh yeah, that most certainly works entirely. And I've always said the same of like, I'd said when I announced Greg's death, I was like, please don't send me any flowers. And actually people did regardless. And I took them all to Greg's mum. Greg's mum loves flowers.
People's home.
So I took all of them there, and like her house was like a shop. Because I was like, I don't want them in my house. I'm it's too much for me. No, the where it came from for me was that I was talking about the idea of love and about when true love really comes to the surface, and that we believe that true love is all about romance and hearts and glitter and flowers and Valentine's Day and holidays and all these kind of big gestures. And I was talking about that when I saw love really come into its own was when I was on my knees and when I was kind of pulverized by the weight of being Greg's carer, because actually in that space there was so many negative feelings, but there was love, and it was the truest, in the truest sense that you can imagine, that kind of emanates out of you. And the it's actually a line from the book where, oh god,
come
I can't
on.
Even remember
off the top
line
of your head.
But it's basically about being scrabbling around in the dirt when this real true love makes an appearance, and the line is, now is not the time for flowers, in the dirt, meaning like it's in this space where you're with each other in this kind of like mutual deep love. It's not when things are blooming. That's not where true love is. It's not when you're in these like, you know, you could be on a beautiful hotel or on a lovely holiday or having an expensive
meal,
then,
right?
Or giving these. Yeah, it's easy. It's so easy in those moments. But when it is really fucking hard, that is when real love shows up. And it's in those moments, as in like, that's not when you have the flowers. You don't have that. The glitter and the hearts popping behind you. I think it's taken from a chapter that's called Love is the Color of Dirt, which is this idea that you, when you are in those moments in love, is when you are covered in dirt and you've got bruises on you and you're bleeding from your knees. And I don't think you have to have been a carer to have been in that situation, like thinking about you and your situation of how you were told about Ben dying and being thrown into this pit of despair on your own, and about how love showed up in that moment for you. That is, it's the same thing.
And I genuinely think, and cliche and sort of trite as it sounds, that my love and respect for Ben and what we built has kept me going, because I actually wasn't known for being a particularly strong person. I've generally lived with other people. Actually, on the day Ben died, I was in school playground, you know, cavalier. Oh, Ben died tomorrow. I'd have no idea how to pay the gas bill. But I kind of owed it to him. And when you talk about hearing Greg's voice, there was a moment when I went to look at a different primary school for my kids, and I could just almost physically feel him going, just do it. This is the right thing to do. And whilst you can't necessarily live your life in terms of what they would have wanted, there is a degree of me wanting to be the person that he thought I was, that he believed in me. You know, he thought I was literally the best thing since sliced bread. And I felt the same way about him. And I kind of owed it to him and myself and my kids to just kind of keep
fucking going, and to use that love, because I've got, there's a quote from a children's book, and it's something like, in the moonlit side, love like starlight never dies. And I really like that, because yes, they have died, but all, and there's the there's another quote, isn't it? All that remains of us is love, because that is all that's going to remain of any of us. And we are fortunate that we have living, breathing, arguing, answering back little versions of our late spouses too. So we've got this kind of physical manifestation, but all that love that they poured into us, that's got to go somewhere. It doesn't just vanish, does it? I don't know. I'm probably not doing a terribly articulate way of explaining this, but
I totally understand you. I totally get it. I feel like if you have lived next to somebody for so long, a bit like you were saying about hearing what they would say in any particular situation, you became the person you are because they were next to you, because of their influence, because of how the dynamic worked between the two of you. So actually, even when they're gone and they're not here, that still exists, because their influence on you is still out in the world in everything you do. Yeah. And I take great solace in that. I think that for me, I don't need to visit a psychic to try to get in contact with Greg. I don't need to believe in robins or white feathers or signs. For me, I am just like, God, you know what? I feel him. I just feel like, and I don't mean like, I believe he's here. I know him. I know how he made me feel. I know how he would react to things. And there's an energy that comes from that. And I feel that.
Out of curiosity, have you done anything? And I don't mean anything lewd, I won't press you on anything like that, but have you done anything that Greg like really wouldn't have approved of?
Probably.
That's a big question, isn't it? I'm just thinking like stupid things. Probably. Like Ben wasn't a fan of my nose ring. And it wasn't like he sat me down and went, you have to take your nose ring out. But over the years, I got on prop job, took it out. And then it was about a year or so after he died. And I was like, I put my nose ring back in. And it was just like a stupid little thing. But I was like, I'm going to do that.
Yeah. I wouldn't have said it was like a thing that Greg would disagree with. But I redecorated my bedroom. And I did it in a way that was exactly how I wanted it. And I was a bit like, oh my God, I'm getting a bit too much joy out of this, of like being like, wow, I don't have to ask anybody for if they like it. I just get to have it exactly as I want. And do you know what? That's one of those really complicated, nuanced things that like, I don't know if you get until you've been through it.
No,
I don't know.
And I think when you've been with somebody for a very long time as well, you are a unit. You make your decisions together, like yourself. You know, we had our first bought a house, had children, got married, did all the sort of the growing up together. And then all of a sudden the buck stops with you. And there's nobody to say, what do you think about this? Do you think this is the right choice? So I became an adult, I think, for want of a better term, because I do tend to look to other people for answers. And I mean, there's jokes in there, you know, when you look around for the responsible adult and realize it's you. Well, that's how I felt. But not that I would in a million years wish this upon myself, and the fact that I've had to find out this about myself through such a brutal way. But I am a better person. I am. I'm definitely kinder. I'm more compassionate. I'm sober. I've built a new career out of something that I would never have had the balls to just sit behind a microphone and talk about my life. And so all of that has happened as a result of this horrible thing. But it's that taking a terrible thing and trying to find something good to do with it. And I think if you can do that, then that's where you find your hope.
I think it's a very weird, it's a weird dynamic, isn't it? It's a weird thing to be involved in, because I felt exactly the same, of that I feel like a better person in general. I think I'm way less judgmental.
Oh God, yeah.
Weirdly, I feel more able to access a lot of happiness in a way that I couldn't before. I think I enjoy things more. I think I've got bigger ideas about what I want to do. I don't have as many limitations on myself. And I think that all of that comes from knowing that this ends, And I don't mean in an abstract way of like, well, we're all going to die, aren't we? Of like, yeah, but we really fucking are. But we really, really are. And it's going to come sooner than you think. And I think with that knowledge comes this feeling of like, wow, I've got to live. Yeah. I've got to live, because who knows when the next phone call's going to come? Who knows when the next doctor's appointment's going to come? And it is a very strange idea and feeling to reckon with, because it comes from, it's in direct correlation with the demise of the person you love the most. And how do you come to terms with that? It's such a weird feeling, such a weird feeling.
And did you go through massive health anxiety as well? The way you're convinced that you're going to die and your children are going to be orphans.
Constantly. And even now, I have to say to people, people I'm really close to, will start a story. They'll like a long-winded story about something. And I sometimes can be a bit rude about things where I'm like, cut to the chase. Tell me what happened. Because I'm like, I can't cope anymore. I can't hear of like, oh, I spoke to so-and-so. She's been to see the doctors. So she went there and, you know, she was telling them. And I'm like,
they're going to die.
Whoa. Just tell me, are they going to die? Like, I can't do the preamble. Don't send me a message saying, give me a ring when you can. No, do not say that to me. So yeah, I feel very, yeah. I mean, I feel like I was saying, I feel like my ability to kind of grasp joy in a bigger way, to set myself bigger, expansive goals of how to live.
What's going to happen? You're going to die, right?
Exactly. And also I think that, you know, there is the yin to the yang, in that I've got all these positive, you know, you could class them as positive things. But there is also, like you said, there's the health anxiety. There's the terror of when the next thing's going to happen. There is the real brokenness inside me of the lack of naivety that I will never get back. I will never, ever be able to see the world in that kind of really lovely, naive way ever again. I will never have that. So I suppose it's kind of, do you know what? I'm thrilled at the payoff. If I've got to have, it's a bit like me wearing my ridiculous, crazy widow outfit, is that, do you know what? If I've got to be plagued by all of these thoughts and broken feelings for the rest of my life about how I've seen life work, then do you know what? I want to feel happy. I want to be able to feel joy and growth and take risks. I want to be able to do that, because it's the only payoff for having dealt with so much shit.
Yeah, I entirely agree with you. And I'm prone to bouts of low mood. I'm not depressed. And I feel this is something I've battled with, the diagnosis of depression, because I'm not depressed. But neurological condition of view, I am prone to sort of bouts of darkness, which I'm managing in a veritable concoction of ways. But what frustrates me in that moment is I've been given another chance at life. So many people don't find loved ones, and I found it twice. And I get don't waste it. And although that can become another stick to beat myself with, there's also an element of no, pull yourself together, because you're here. You're still here. Yeah. Sometimes it's easier said than done, but I think that your attitude is kind of similar to mine. So obviously I like it, but that I'm not dead. I'm not dead. The person I loved is, and that is awful. Yeah. And nothing I ever say or do or accomplish or achieve is ever going to make that okay. But I'm not. And my son, and this just popped into my head, but my teenage boy, completely unprompted, I was talking about the podcast and I was saying, oh God, I'm going to put out episode 100 this week and then, next series. And he just looked at me completely out of the blue and went, Dad would be so proud of you, you know.
Oh God.
I know.
What a killer.
I know. Just think all that work that you've put into pulling yourself, you've stared into the abyss, right? And we've been dangled over and you've managed to hoik yourself back. And each time you come back from the edge, you get a little bit further back from the edge and it becomes a little bit scary, less scary. But it takes guts and it takes I'm going to say it, resilience, to get yourself off that ledge and back into the world of the living. And I think that you are incredible for what you've done. I really can't wait to read your book. There was the lure of missing an email copy, but unfortunately, you didn't follow on that stage, so I can't say it.
Oh, my God. Did I? Oh, I'm so sorry.
Do you know
what?
I only remembered when I sat in front of the microphone, so I'm pretending it's your fault. It's not.
Do you want me to send you the email version?
Or I would
you prefer to have the bit? Oh, okay. Well, yep, right.
Yeah.
Hang on.
Why not?
PDF to Rosie. Yeah, okay.
But if you forget, don't worry, because I'm not going to. It's my pre-order. Is it on your pad?
It's now on my pad of many, many things to do.
I have a blackboard in my kitchen that I write down every morning what's on that day and what time, because and then I have a year planner stuck to a different wall that's supposed to have all the big events that will happen. I mean, I try and hack myself. I really try. It still ends up in carnage. Yeah, but anyway, Stacey, I will not keep you any longer, but thank you ever so much for coming on and talking to me today. I feel like we probably could have fitted another hour of chat, actually, so I might hook you back in again at some point to talk about other things.
I think we could have done. I think we think quite similarly about a lot of things.
I think you're probably right. And also, just to for our listeners, I really would recommend getting this book. I say it as I've not read it, but I've read extracts from it. And as I said earlier in the interview, I am insanely jealous that you, because this podcast came about because I wanted to write a book, but I could not get myself to just sit down and write. So I decided that I would start collecting stories, thinking I'd maybe get 10 or 15. Well, it's rolled.
Oh my God.
So at some point I've got this kind of abstract idea of turning people's stories into a book. But so I'm really.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, well, you know, you get to be in it now.
Wow.
But
do
so
it.
Thank you for coming on and for sharing
Pleasure.
Your story and for talking about Greg. And I wish you all the best with the book. And
Thank you so much.
Hopefully our paths will cross again soon. But for now, you take care.
Thank you. Thank you so much.